Today, I'm going to finish the discussion of renormalization theory at one loop for phi to the 4 in perturbation theory. I hope I'm going to answer some of your questions. And I shall start to discuss the relation between perturbative renormalization in QFT and Wilsonian renormalization in statistical mechanics that you have seen at the end of the statistical mechanics lecture. And I think because it's also a very useful way to look and to think about renormalization in quantum field theory. So first, I'm going to finish discussion of renormalization at one loop. And second, I'm going to start to discuss perturbative, if you want. Perturbative versus Wilsonian renormalization. And so first, since I managed to get confused in computing the beta function of the phi-4 theory, let's start it again shortly in a slightly different way. So we're going to see what's going on. So we have seen that at one loop for the massless phi-4, you can construct a well-defined quantum field theory with no ultraviolet singularities at one loop, so at first order in perturbation theory, by using what's called counter terms, so starting from a bare action in a theory which is defined with a cutoff, which is different from what you would have expected. So what's important are the renormalized coupling. We have seen that we have the renormalized coupling. The definition of the renormalized coupling depends on the renormalization scale. Okay, because it depends how you measure and you define the coupling. And if you have a bare theory, you have a bare coupling, if you want, that I'm going to call G bare, which in my case corresponds to the constant C in the action in the functional integral, which is called the bare coupling, in a theory which is defined with an ultraviolet momentum cutoff. Okay. And we have seen from the calculation that the relation between the bare coupling you have to use in the functional integral in order to obtain a sensible massless phi-4 theory with a renormalized coupling GR at renormalization scale mu. The relation is simply that G bare, which is equal to the parameter, the coefficient C in at one loop, is G renormalized plus a counter term, which is G renormalized squared, 3/2, and then a coefficient proportional to the divergence of the one loop diagram, which is log of lambda squared over mu squared. Okay. And in the limit, in the ultraviolet, in the continuum limit, you have to set lambda to infinity, keeping GR fixed. So we have seen that we have defined what's called the beta function for the coupling constant, as how G renormalized must change when you change the renormalization scale for a given theory, for a given physical quantum field theory, so a given physical model. Okay. So the beta function, beta of G, or is just the logarithmic derivative with respect to mu of GR when the physics is fixed. So if you define the physics, for instance, at a given renormalization scale mu naught and a given GR naught, if you compute the same quantity but express it in terms of another mu, you have to adjust gr so that the physics doesn't change. Okay. So one way to do that, in fact, you have to remember, is that you can do that by keeping lambda and g bar fixed. Because if the action, the renormalized action is fixed and lambda in fixed, that's equivalent to state that SR of phi is fixed and lambda is fixed. The functional integral is what it is, the correlation are what it is. So that's how we, but of course we have to take the continuum limit. So in fact, you can define beta of G renormalized as mu dd mu of G renormalized, but you have to take the continuum limit. So in fact, you have to take the limit when lambda goes to infinity of the functional derivative of the derivative of gr defined by this formula when g bar and lambda are fixed. So first, you compute this derivative, and then you compute the limit when lambda goes to infinity and gr is fixed. So you see, it's a bit subtle. First, you take this relation and you let g bar and lambda fixed. You compute the variation of g renormalized. And once you have get that result, you take the limit when lambda is fixed and g bar is fixed, because it corresponds to this constraint. Okay, so you can do the calculation very easily, because if we, so we take the limit of this. So we make a variation of mu. So if we have, if we make a variation of mu, this induced a variation of G renormalized with this constraint. So let's compute it. This means that the variation of this is zero. The variation of this is first the variation of GR, so it's dGR times 1 plus 2GR, 3 half of 1 over 4 pi squared log of lambda divided by mu squared. That's the term that comes from the variation of GR. And then you have a term that comes from the variation of mu squared, which is minus 2 d mu over mu, that's the variation of the logarithm of 1 over mu squared, times gr squared, 3 half, 1 over 4 pi squared. Okay? So now, once we have this, so we end up with dgr over mu d mu by this relation equals to 3 gr squared 1 over 4 pi squared. This is the first term, plus a term of order gr cube, which come from this term. So this term contains logs of lambda over mu. So it's singular in this limit. But this term is finite. Okay. And that's the two-loop contribution, the one-loop term. This is a two-loop contribution. And in order to compute the beta function at two loop, you have to take into account the renormalization effect that comes from two loop diagram that contains log of lambda squared. And they are going to cancel the log of this term. So this is a beta function for and you see it has a plus sign, as it should. Okay, so this is the first point, calculation of the beta function. So, second point, I told you that if you integrate this equation, so if you compute how does gr of mu obtained by solving this equation, here, the very definition. So if you define gr of mu solving this equation, this corresponds to an effective coupling constant at scale mu. And some of you were confused about that. So let me explain it in more detail. So remember that the renormalized coupling constant, in fact, in our scheme, was defined by the value of the four-point function at a given point where all the momenta were of order mu. But we may consider something more general. We may consider the irreducible four-point function, namely the interaction vertex for the 5-4 theory, which is the four-point function of a set of momenta. Let me denote these p's, okay, pi's. I goes from 1, so this is p1, p2, p3, p4. So you have some incoming momenta. Okay. And for a given theory, if you compute it in perturbation theory, it's a function of gr and, of course, of mu. And I gave yesterday the explicit expression, remember. It's gr, and then there is a term of gr squared that involves the logs of the momenta in the different channels. Okay, but so you consider this for specific pi momenta. Okay, so this is, and out of that, for instance, you can compute what is scattering amplitudes of two particles incoming, two particles outgoing in the theory at given momenta, namely at given energies. So you can get, for instance, what is the total cross section at the given energy. Okay. So now the question is, this is a number for given pi, and you may ask, how does this scale, with energy? And remember, the pi's are energy and momenta. So pi is something like E k in I'm in momentum space, but then you can go back to in Euclidean space, but you can go back to Euclidean space. So in my notation, the pi I have some I times some energy and k, because I'm in Euclidean space-time, but from the formula for Euclidean space-time, you get what is this. Okay. So does this scale with energy? It means what happens if you rescale the momenta pi into some lambda pi's to rescale all the momenta. Okay, lambda is just a scaling parameter, scaling factor, so it's different from, it's a small lambda. It's not the capital lambda, which is the ultraviolet momentum cutoff, which goes to infinity. So it's just a pure number. Okay? And in fact, in order to make the connection with Wilsonian normalization, rather than lambda, I'm going to consider the inverse of lambda that I'm going to call S, which is a scaling factor, which is a scaling factor in position space. So you see, so large lambda means small s, which means small distances. High energy and high momenta, or small distances. So you are probing the property of your quantum field theory at short distance. Okay, so I'm going to, so obviously, so what I'm going to do is that I'm going to write this as pi divided by s. I divide all the momenta by a scaling factor. Okay, and if s is small, I am increasing the momenta. Okay? So, can we get something out of this? Well, in fact, we know how this variable s, because first remember, gamma 4 of the momenta and gr and mu is gr plus gr squared times some logs of mu divided by some momenta squared with some coefficients and some sum over channels at first order. So in fact, gamma 4, the four-point function, is a dimensionless number because gr is dimensionless, and it's a function of mu divided by p. It has to be dimensionless. So the only. So this is, by dimensional analysis, equal to pi gr mu s. Because divided p by s amounts to multiply mu by s. Okay? And so, so this is just dimensional analysis. But now we know that this is a change of mu. So we can, changing this mu amounts to change dr. So this is gamma 4 of pi's, some gr of s mu. And this is what renormalization theory tells you. So this is, in some sense, a classical statement, and this is a quantum statement about the quantum theory. Okay. And we know how what happens when, if you change mu, how gr changes. And because of the beta function, and if you work out things, and you realize that when you change s, this has to change at minus beta of grs. Okay? Minus because the beta function is defined as, if I change this, how must I change this so that this is constant? But I'm interested in, this is non-constant, so I must go backward. I must go, what is the change of s that amount to changing mu in mu s, so hence the minus sign. Okay. And you see that with this equation, which is just a rewriting of the equation, gr of s is just the effective or running coupling at energies rescaled by a factor s minus 1 over s, or at distances rescaled by factor s. Okay. And high energy means small s. Yes?
Can you explain what you're doing in the last step once again? We have US, then how, can you explain what happened in the last cycle? You had gamma 4 PID in the US, and then you have this new GR list.
You want to understand the relation between this and this? Well, that's simply because I know that the beta function is defined that by the fact that G4 of some momenta GR of mu is equal to gamma 4 of the same momenta GR of mu prime. Mu prime. You see? So I'm just choosing as mu prime mu s and rewrite the equation. So you see, here I'm choosing mu prime equal mu s, and my question is what is the value of GR of U prime. Okay. So it's really an effective coupling. When you compare physical, for instance, scattering amplitudes at energies that are rescaled, although the theory is massless, so it should be scale invariant, it is not scale invariant. Okay.
Is all the argument is intact only for the system having scale invariance?
No. This theory, the statement, well, these statements amount to say that the theory is in fact not scale invariant. Because if you look at it at difference energy or distance scale, it's not the same. It's not described by a theory with the same coupling. So this goes to the third point I wanted to discuss. I'm going to discuss it briefly, but third point has been that the fact that the beta function is different from zero means that scale invariance is anomalous. It is broken by quantum effects. Okay, so that's, so this phenomenon is called the scale anomaly. Okay, and I hope it's there and not further, but in fact, remember, I explained yesterday that, where is it? I explained yesterday that the classical 5-4 theory is scale invariant. Ah, here it is, yes. Classical theory, classical 5-4, 5-4 theory in d equal 4 dimension is scale invariant. It means that if you change any field phi of x into phi lambda of x, and I should write this s because this corresponds to the s factor here, as s phi of sx. This is a scale transformation. The action of phi s is equal to s, the action of phi. So that's, so if you make a transformation on the field and the action doesn't change, it means that you have a symmetry of the theory. Okay. And you have seen in the front end that there is a theorem, the Noether theorem tells that to a symmetry implies a current. So there is a current associated to this symmetry. And this current, in fact, you can compute it. This current, so there is a current G mu associated to scale invariant. And this current, well, you can compute it. It's, in four dimension, it's just T mu nu X nu. You are rescaling around the origin, so it has to depend on the origin, plus phi d mu phi. Okay, that's one of the way to d mu is a mu upstairs, but that's we are in Euclidean space. So, okay. So this is the current associated to the scale anomaly when you dilate around the origin. So you change x into sx. Okay, this scaling. And you can check that classically, this current is divergence free, it's conserved. D mu G mu scale is equal to zero classically. So it's a conserved current, so this is a symmetry. Well, now if you compute it, this object, in the quantum theory, so now you have, and T mu nu, I remind you that T mu nu in the 5-4 theory is just the free, it's a stress energy tensor, so it's Z mu phi D nu phi minus delta mu nu, the Lagrangian density, where the Lagrangian density is, as we have seen, 1/2 of D phi D phi, D mu D mu, plus g over factorial 4, phi to the 4. Okay, so this is a stress energy tensor. Stress energy tensor, remember, is a current associated to translation invariance. So it's normal that if you make a change of variable, change of coordinate that is not a translation, but it's locally some kind of translation, it should involve the stress energy tensor. So in fact, this stems from the fact that you change x into sx, and these terms come from the fact that you change phi into s phi. So this is dilation of space. Space, this comes from the dilation of the field. Okay. So for the classical theory, this is true. Now for the quantum theory, this becomes operators, you know, or fluctuating variables. So, and you have products of fluctuating variables here, here, here. So you have products of random variables, and you must be very careful because they may contain some singular terms. So at one loop in the quantum theory, you must be careful because of short distance singularities. Must be define this in a precise way. You can do that and just setting the result. What you find at the quantum level, so we have seen that this is zero at leading order, but you find that at there is a one loop correction, which is of order gr squared. Okay. It's proportional to the interaction term, because in fact, if there were no interaction, this would be just free field theory, which is conformally invariant, which is scale invariant. And you find that it is proportional to the interaction term in the action. And you find a factor which is precisely 3 over 4 pi cube. That's the calculation. And that's the result of the one loop contribution. And you see that first this is non-zero. This means that the scale current is not conserved. So the anomaly is broken by symmetry effects. And second, this is simply the beta function of GR times the interaction term. So you see that the beta function can be viewed as just the anomaly. It's called the beta function equal anomaly. Coefficient of the scale anomaly. And anomalies are a very important feature of quantum field theory. They are related to the existence of short distance singularity. And I don't know if you have seen anomalies in QFT1. I might say a word about that in next week about gauge theories, but many, well, or several important classical symmetries in energy physics are broken by anomalies. And that's very important to understand which symmetries of a classical theory, of a first quantized theory, that's which symmetry of the Dirac field are preserved or not. Yes?
Is the energy momentum of the scalar field a trace tree? Is the energy momentum, is the trace zero? I'm just asking
this. Well, the angular momentum is associated to the rotation invariance by Lorentz transformation. The energy momentum, of course, is it is not trace free. If you work out this and this and this, you see, if you compute d mu of g mu, you get t mu mu. Basically,
this introduce a length scale in our theory because we say that classically we have a scale in there in theory. But how can this?
No, it doesn't introduce a scale because everything is dimensionless. It tells you that it depends on the scale.
Yeah, but t is not dimensionless. T mu. So if I can contract it with the metric and I get something that is zero,
t mu mu is dimensionless because if you think expressed in the correct expression. It's dimensionless because phi has a dimension of the inverse. Well, t mu nu, if you want, I think t mu mu is dimensionless, if you think. The trace of the stress energy tensor. Because it contains t mu nu with indices below is dimension as dimension 2. But if you take the trace, you have a g mu nu, so you have the metric tensor, which is dimension minus 2. So this is, I think everything is OK. T mu mu is just a pure number, because it's g mu nu, t mu nu. This is dimension. This has a dimension. OK?
No, because I was asking this because, I mean, this trace anomaly means usually that something that the expectation value of the trace, for example, in electrodynamics is zero.
In
electrodynamics, if you think about, then this guy is trace-free. But if you go to quantum effects, it's no longer trace-free. And I was just wondering if this is also happening here.
Yeah, so in fact, this happens. Because if you compute d mu of t mu nu and use this expression, well, of course, this may depend on x, but the main... Roughly speaking, this is related to T mu mu. Okay, but I don't want to be too much precise at that stage, otherwise get confused. But there is a relation. There is a clear relation in dimension 2. But here we are in dimension 4. But you are going to see this concept of scale anomaly, beta functions, trace of the strain energy tensor. I'm sure you are going to have a course in conformal field theory and string theory. Well, this is very important. OK, so for more, see CFT and string theory. OK. So the third point I wanted to, so this was the third point. The fourth point I wanted to discuss very briefly is renormalization of the massive series. Because we have considered the massless theory, and I'm just going to state the result. Massive theory, that means that you want that the physical mass is different from zero. And of course, it means that in your renormalized action of the field that we have to use, remember, this was d4xa divided by 2 d mu phi squared plus b divided by 2 phi squared plus c divided by factorial 4 phi 4. Remember that in order to construct the free field theory, the massless theory, we showed that we could take a equal 1, b equal minus some lambda squared gr 1 over 4 pi squared. Well, there might be a 1 half. No, b, because b is here, so I think it's OK. Perhaps it was a 1 half. I don't. Well, let me check already. I don't know this by heart, and I should. Yes, there was a factor of 1 half. And C was this famous renormalization factor. So there was this renormalized. And then plus, that's what I wrote here. So GR squared, 3 over 4 pi squared. There was a factor of 1 half. And there was this log of lambda squared, so mu squared. OK. So this is a massless theory. So in order to have a physical theory, it means that, in fact, basically, you expect that B has to be this term plus something different. Okay, and this something different is going to be some renormalized mass. That's just a classical term, plus something else. And remember that we have seen that this diagram, the tadpole diagram with truncated amplitudes as a function, that's something that I call T. Its amplitude diverges like lambda squared with some coefficient related to this one. And I show that if the mass is different from zero, then there is a log lambda with some coefficient. I gave yesterday. So it means that you expect that there is a logarithmic divergence proportional to the mass that you have to adjust in order to have a theory which is ultraviolet finite when it is not massless. Okay, so you work this out, and that's an exercise that I think you might be interested in the later on. And what you find is that this coefficient is plus, so you get 1, and then you get plus, so let me write this, you get plus mr squared gr 1 over 4 pi squared 1 half log of lambda squared divided by mu squared. So those two terms are the counter terms. One loop counter terms. This is a new counter term that you have to adjust in order for the theory to be massive but ultraviolet finite. And if you work out this, you check that everything is fine. the COA is ultraviolet finite, but you found that the renormalized two-point function as a function of the momentum is now p squared plus the physical mass squared plus term of order gr squared that comes from two-loop effects. And it's an exercise to find that the physical mass squared computed with this scheme of renormalization is not mr squared, it's mr squared 1 plus gr 1 half 1 over 4 pi squared log of mr squared divided by mu squared. Okay, that's an exercise. Okay, so this mr is a parameter. Mr is called the renormalized mass. Again, gr is the renormalized coupling. And again, you see that since you had a log here, you had to introduce some renormalization scale if you want to work out things carefully. So let's take the same renormalization scale. And you see that with this parameter, you see the physical mass, so which is a physical observable, depend on gr and on mu. Depends on mr and on mu. So you see that, again, a change in mu must be reabsorbed into a change in gr and mr in order to keep the same physics. So in fact, there is an effective renormalized mass for the particles. But the physical mass of the particle, if you can observe it, is finite. Of course, it's fixed because it's fixed by the physics. So renormalization effect doesn't change the mass of the electron with the scale because the mass of the electron is defined at the mass at rest. The energy at rest of an electron, okay? But this effect that the renormalized mass depends on the may be important, for instance, in QCD, because in QCD you have quarks inside the hadrons. Quarks are massive particles, but you cannot observe them because of confinement. So you cannot observe a quark at rest and measure its mass because you cannot isolate the quarks out of an hadron, proton or neutron. And therefore, when one, in on-books, you define what are the mass of the quarks, that's a perfectly well-defined quantity, but it's, you have, one has to be a bit careful, so it's made precisely, but what is the mass of the quarks? Okay, so this is 4 point. And the, yes?
I'm pretty confused now because we have physical mass, we have renormalized mass, and we have bare mass.
Yes. Yeah, it's you shouldn't be confused. First, the bare mass is just a parameter you have introduced at your intermediate step when you define your COE with an ultraviolet cutoff. But once you take the continuum limit, you can forget about the bare mass. Okay? Now you have the COE massive five-fold should depend on two parameters: coupling constant and mass. And some mass. Okay. And you have physical observable, and you have renormalized couplings that are, if you want, intermediate steps that you use in your calculation. And that, that corresponds to some observable at some physical energy scale, at some energy scale. Okay? And the difference is that, of course, if you have a massive theory, a theory, the 5-4, which is massive, then you have the elementary particle, the excitation, the boson, the one particle state is massless, is massive. So it can stay at rest, and you can put it here if you want, and put it on a scale and weight it. So you can measure the physical mass. Therefore, the physical mass can be observed, but still, you have, when you do the calculation, this concept of renormalized mass and the renormalized mass that is needed when you do calculation, which is needed when you do, for instance, high energy physics, and forget about what is physical mass because you are doing experiment at energies much larger than the energy of the particle. So this concept exists, but it depends on mu. So physical observable correspond to quantity you can measure, and renormalized parameters correspond, if you want, to coordinates in the space of theory. You see?
Okay. It's become a bit clear when we are going to discuss the Wilsonian normalization. Why do we see that with something?
So don't be confused. Bare couplings are things that are important if you assume that there is a physical cutoff. But in quantum physics, you get rid of a physical cutoff because you are interested in constructing a theory in a continuum space-time. Physical parameters, like the physical mass of a one particle state, are observable. And renormalized parameters, like the renormalized mass and the renormalized coupling, are numbers that parameterize the renormalized theory. So you, in a given renormalization scale, you perform your calculation and you characterize your theory in terms of the parameter of the theory relative to this renormalization scale. But you cannot measure a renormalized coupling if you do not specify the scale. Okay. Okay. Okay, so I still have 20 minutes. So what did I want to do? Okay, perhaps one last point before going to the connection with renormalization. Yes?
Like, how do you calculate any observable quantity? Like, we calculate current or momentum before renormalization, but now, how do you?
You mean compared to what you did in QFT1?
Yeah. What is the difference?
No, there is no difference. For instance, in QFT1, you computed, for instance, scattering amplitudes in QED. Correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not checking what you have done. I had no point in checking. If you compute the scattering amplitudes, you know, some scattering amplitudes of two incoming, let's say, electrons, and two outgoing electrons. This is an E minus E plus something, okay, E minus E plus. Well, usually when you do that at high energy, lots of things come out, but at low energy, you can only create some photons. Okay, so that's the scattering amplitudes. Out of that, you compute, you measure some cross section. Okay, and you have seen that this is basically described by some. If this is E plus and E minus, it should rather go like the way, so you have some process like that. Okay, so you do the diagrammatic compute, you get numbers. Okay, then at one loop, you have those famous diagrams, but I'm going to discuss that later. kernel. And this diagram, this one I think is okay, but this diagram contains some ultraviolet singularities. Okay? So you have to renormalize to treat the theory. And this term is proportional to alpha squared. Well, to no, alpha is e squared, because you have two interaction vertices that proportional to charge. And this term is proportional to alpha 4. So it means that you have to renormalize the charge of the electron, the strength of the interaction between electromagnetic field and the electron. So you have to renormalize the electron. So that this is finite. And that's what the pioneer of QED did. And once you have performed in a consistent way renormalization of QED, then you get finite physical observable. Okay? But those physical observable depend on alpha renormalized, the renormalized fine structure constant, or the renormalized charge of the electron, in a way that depends on the way you have chosen to renormalize the theory, namely on the definition, precise definition of an alpha of R, and in particular on the renormalization scale you choose. But the final result is depends only on the momenta. And it's something that is, of course, not doesn't should not depend on normalization. Yes?
But after we renormalized, then we don't draw any one particle irreducible vertices anymore, right? Because we've absorbed them. Or would we still draw the value search?
That sits there in your calculation. What's important is the final result of the calculation.
Yeah.
Okay. So draw, well, Feynman diagram are intermediate tools, calculational tools. They are very important, but they are nothing but calculational tool and a diagrammatic representation of what you are, of the physical quantity you are computing. So they are very important. They give a physical picture of what is a quantum process, which in, you know, in the 30s was a big black box for physicists, in terms of exchange of virtual particles and intermediate quantum process. So that's, they give you a language to understand what is a quantum process, and they give you a way to calculate, a procedure to calculate quantum process. But there are intermediate steps. The physical object is this. And you are going to see in CFT theory and in some problem in string theory that people nowadays try to avoid the use of Feynman diagram, or can completely avoid the use of Feynman diagrams, because they have other tools to deal with CFT, with conformal field theory and some quantum field theory. Okay? So Feynman diagrams are very important, but keep in mind there are tools. Yes?
So suppose we start with the theory with non-zero, like we renormalize fast, can we make it to be, after we renormalization, make it to be a zero physical mass?
Yes, that's what I did last week, last days, yes. You have to take these counter terms and set MR equal to zero, because then this term and this term vanish.
Can we start with the theory that MR is not zero, but still make it to be zero physical mass?
What do you mean by start with the theory is MR non-zero?
Because like originally we assumed that B has zero contributions at zero at leading orders, and then it has a H bar contribution from the green
value. No, I think it's just if you are trying to do that, it just means that you are putting pieces of this and redefine it here. What's important is the physical mass. Okay.
So as far as that part equals zero, we don't care.
So you can understand what I'm doing because
remember that, in fact, if you think about the fact that you are doing a semi-classical expansion, so you consider h bar as a parameter of your theory, and completely independently, that mr, gr are parameters of order one.
Yeah,
so you see. Either you do perturbation theory by assuming that gr is small, but you may also, and usually mr is taken to be of order one, and gr is taken to be small, but you may reformulate everything, assuming that you have a parameter which is h bar, and gr and mr are parameter of order one. Then you have an h bar here, you have an h bar here, you have an h bar here, okay? And so when you, in this framework, if you are setting, I start from an mr which is different from zero, and then I compute the one loop order, it means that you start from a theory where h bar equals zero, so classical theory, and consider that mr is different from zero. But in this case, the physical mass is zero if and only if the renormalized mass is zero. And then you start to switch on h bar. And for small but non-zero h bar, you must introduce a counter term. And in this case, h bar, you get a small correction, which is zero if mr is equal to zero. But if you want to compensate this term by this term so that the physical mass is equal to zero, if this term is of order one and this term is of order one, it means that you have a regime, and gr is of order one, it means that you have a regime where h bar is of order one, which is not what I'm doing. And remember that in this kind of argument, you say, okay, I stop my calculation at one loop, it means always that I'm in the back of my mind that I treat h bar as a parameter, and I consider that h bar is small. But then I know that considering that h bar is small is equivalent to make a calculation with gr small, and h bar is what it is. Okay, so I wanted to discuss once more something, but I'm not sure I will have time now. But let's just say a few words. I think yesterday one of you asked me what is the connection with renormalizable and non-renormalizable theory, and I realized that you have discussed that with David Kubisniak in the course in statistical mechanics. So if you want, you can say, why do renormalization work? Okay, and what happens if the dimension of space-time is different from 4? Because I did specific calculation. I hope I have convinced you that it works, but it's an experimental math. Of course, there are theorems that say why, but why do this renormalization, this feature that by modifying the coefficient in the action in the functional integral, you get a finite tablet, why does it work? And should it work at higher order? And the reason is, the point is that the reason is that short distance singularity in quantum field theory are proportional to local operators. Okay? and I'm going to explain what it means. And that's, in fact, a consequence of the fact that what QFT are local theory. Everything can be expressed in terms of local operators. CO is. And locality is a very important property, because locality is an essential ingredient for having causality and Lorentz invariance. Causality is that you need that no information and no energy can propagate at speed larger than light. Okay, fast, no faster than light effects, physical effects. Okay, no faster than light physical effect. I don't call EPR correlation, I don't count them as physical effects. They are correlation, but they do not carry, you cannot use them to change something in a faster than light way. Okay. And, okay, I'm going to explain, oh, no, that's a bit. Okay, let me just explain that in a very sketchy way. Remember, when you compute correlation function in the interacting theory, you reduce this to computation of products of operator, where you have insertion of phi 4 operators in the free theory. Zero means free theory. Okay, and we have seen that, for instance, this famous divergence here comes from this diagram that I represented in momentum space. But these diagrams come from, in fact, if you go back to the representation in momentum space, to one Feynman diagram where you have two phi 4 here, you see, this phi 4, this phi 4. Propagator relating those phi to other phi, so other phi 4. But that's happening when x1 goes to x2. See? And we know that the propagator in momentum in position space is proportional to x1 minus x2 to the power minus 2. We have two propagators. So this is x1 minus x2 squared. And we have integral d4 of x1, d4 of x2. So when x1 goes to x2, this diverges logarithmically. You see. But now, you see, the divergence is just, roughly speaking, equal to the divergence associated to this term. Let's say d4y over y to the power 4, where y is x1 minus x2, times integral d4 of, let's say, x1, times this diagram, the contribution, because when x1 is very close to x2, the Feynman diagram in this, the two points may be considered are equal, which is just equal to a phi 4 operator at point x1. You see? And this gives the log of lambda divergence, because basically the divergence lambda is something like 1 over the minimal distance. Okay. So you see that the divergence, in fact, when it comes to this graph, is proportional to a phi 4 operator. So now, if you forget about what's going on when you integrate over momenta, and you are just interested in what's happening when you consider two operators, phi of 1 of x1, phi 4 of x2, okay, in a integral, and you are interested in what's happening when x1 goes to x2. This term, in fact, this Feynman diagram tells you that part of these products of two operators diverges like x1 minus x2 minus 4 times phi 4 of x1. Well, now this is random variables or operator in canonical formalism. Okay. So this comes from this diagram. But now, when you consider two phi 4 operator at two points, you have this diagram, okay, that I'm going to draw here. But you also have this diagram, and you have this vacuum diagram. You see. And this diagram diverges like three propagators. So you get an x1 minus x2 minus 6 times. Now you have two propagators that meet at the same point where those two points come together. So this is proportional to an operator phi square of x1. And this vacuum diagram, if you think of it, is diverged like x1 minus x2 to the power minus 8 times just something that doesn't depend on what's going on elsewhere. So the identity operator, point x1. Okay? And in fact, this operator, so these diagrams provide to the operator 1. This diagram corresponds to the operator phi to the 4. These diagrams correspond to an operator phi squared. And if you work a little bit more, you have to take the second derivative of what's going on. You realize that there is also a contribution, which is of the form x1 minus x2 to the power minus 4 times d phi squared. This requires a bit more of attention. But so this is a very, very sketchy explanation. There are details in the lecture notes. But that's something very, very, very important, because it states that if a quantum field theory, here the quantum free, the free field, you take two operators, two local observables, and you approach them, you know, you have some kind of, Taylor expansion around zero, but which involves a large bunch of other operators, you see, with coefficients that diverge in general, minus 6, minus 4, minus 8, minus 4. And those divergences are the reason why there are ultraviolet divergences in perturbation theory. That's it. Okay. So this structure, when you have two operators and you approach them, they merge into a linear combination of other operators with divergent coefficient in general. It's something, a very important feature of quantum field theory, and it's called the operator product expansion. And again, this is due to Ken Wilson. It means that at short distance, you can expand products of operator in terms of a sum of local operators. Okay. And so you see that the diverging coefficient that give rise to the ultraviolet singularity, for instance, here, are proportional to local operators. So this is why all the ultraviolet singular terms reorganize themselves into local operators. And you can, by renormalize the action, control them. If here you had non-local operators or some wilder object, theory would not be renormalized. Okay. And finally, you see, the coefficient here, the divergence, you can compute them by just comparing the dimension of the operator and the dimension of X. And this is the result for D equal 4. So you see, in D equal 4, you have 5-4 times 5-4 equals basically y minus 4, 5-4. So it means that you have just a logarithmic divergence. So the theory is renormalizable. If D is less than 4, 5-4 times 5-4 is y to the power minus 2. D minus 2, 5-4. So the theory is said to be super renormalizable. Super renormalizable because, in fact, this term is convergent because it decays at, it diverges at small distance more slowly than D. Okay, and so forget. And if D is larger than 4, I'm sorry, this is less than 4, this diverges badly because it doesn't diverge like a log, but like some positive power. So the theory is said to be non-renormalizable. Okay? And everything come out of doing some power and, well, dimensional analysis. Okay. So I spent only a few times. This was a very sketchy definition, but keep in mind that the structure of an operator product expansion is an essential feature of quantum field theory. And you are going to see that it plays a very important role, in particular in conformal field theory. Okay.
I understand how we can like group two local operators into like another. I can understand when you wrote in the box, but I cannot connect.
Okay. This will take too much time. This would require a full lecture to explain how this works in detail. I put a lot of details in the, under the carpet, but well, there are some more detailed explanation in the lecture notes, and otherwise just go to some QFT book. Well, this is very classical material, so it's very well explained in many books. Okay, but I think it's important that you know that at that stage. Okay, so finally, let me just start to discuss. Perhaps use this. So this is a real thing. And this is the interplane. So let me start. I'm a bit late with what I scheduled, but that's important. Let me start just to discuss very, very, in a still very qualitative way, what is the relation between this perturbative renormalization, if you want, QFT renormalization. Okay. let's say we can associate these names of Gell-Mann and Lau, of Callan and Simancic, which are, and of course, all the mathematical physicists and physicists have proved that it works at all orders. So in particular, there is an acronym which is BPHZ for Bogolyubov, Parachuk, Epp, and Zimmermann, which is, there is a theorem, let's say, due to those physicists and mathematical physicists that tells that renormalization work at all orders. In perturbation theory, not only at one order, so there is a whole bunch of, and the renormalization by Wilson, a normalization group that I think you have seen, started to discuss in the last two lectures of the statistical mechanics course, as far as I have seen by David Kubisniak, which was very good. Okay, so I'm going to just at that stage, I have slightly 10 minutes, so let me just make some very qualitative picture. Okay, we have seen that in our language, so this is QFT, let me write something like energy scale. Okay, and in order to define a QFT, we have seen that we want to define a theory whose parameters are defined at some renormalization scale. Mu. Okay, so it's a momentum or energy scale, and that's the scale at which we are doing the physics. We are doing experiments. We are computing things. So it may be, you know, EV if you are in a optic laboratory, while micro EV if you are working cold atoms, GEV, MEV, or TEV if you are working in high energy physics. But it is okay. And we have seen that in order to try to define quantum field theory properly, that we introduce an ultraviolet cutoff regulator, lambda, which is much, much larger. And we start by constructing our theory by functional integral method at that scale, but we adjust the theory so that here it is fixed. The physics is fixed. So this is the physics that we want to construct. Okay, so we want to explore this domain of energy. And we start from a physics at ultraviolet cutoff, and we let this ultraviolet cutoff go to infinity, adjusting the physics at that level, the high energy physics that we don't really know, in order to get a well-defined physics here, and showing that the way this is done here has no influence of what is happening here when you take the continuum limit. So lambda, so what the result of renormalization tells you that you can take this limit and it makes sense at this level, at least in perturbation theory. Okay, so that's the picture of QFT, it's high energy physics. Okay, but now remember that we have this dictionary between QFT and statistical mechanics. That I explained at the end of the last week, which basically states that the path integral for phi 4 theory, this integral d of phi, e minus s of phi for phi 4 theory, in fact, is very similar to a partition function of a model of statistical mechanics, a sum, let's say, over spins, Si, of exponential minus 1 over the temperature, H of phi, of sigma I, where H is some energy. Okay? And 4 phi to the 4, the dictionary is in fact that this is nothing but the Landau Ginzburg Wilson Hamiltonian. That is supposed to describe the physics near the critical point of Ising model. So we have a dictionary. And in the dictionary of statistical physics, we have a position scale, if you want, position scale, length scale, let's say. Length scale. And what you're doing in this Wilsonian renormalization group is that you start from a physics at a given microscopic scale. So let us call it A, where A is the mesh of your lattice. So in the Ising model, usually it's set to 1, but it's OK. And then you are asking what's going on at very large scales, L, much, much larger than the microscopic scale. And typically, of course, L is chosen to be of the order of the correlation length of your model. If you have near a critical point, then the correlation length is much larger than the microscopic scale. Okay? And, well, the question in statistical mechanics is that you know this, and you want to know what's the physics here. So if you want, the physics is given there, and you want to understand what's going on here. And Wilson randomization groups, well, the procedure means that you start by, you know the physics, and then you start to integrate out the short distance physics by steps, unless you get, so here you have some microscopic Hamiltonian, and here you get some renormalized effective Hamiltonian through Wilsonian normalization group, you see. But since there is a dictionary between this and this, you see, those two models are exactly the same. We simply just reverse the question. In high energy physics, you keep this fixed, and you ask, what's the microscopic physics that leads to such an effective theory at renormalization scale mu. In statistical physics, you know the microscopic physics, and you are asking what's the macroscopic physics at that scale. But if you want to understand what's going on near a critical point, you want the correlation length to be of the order of the length scales, and you are asking, what is the microscopic physics that leads to a correlation length large? And the answer of Wilsonian normalization group is that in order to get a correlation length large, the microscopic physics has to be adjusted so that you are very close to a critical point, to a special value of the temperature, for instance. which is exactly what you do that. For instance, having an infinite correlation length means having a zero mass renormalized mass. And we have seen that in order to have a zero renormalized mass, the bare mass has to be adjusted at something that plays a role of the critical point. So the coefficient B here, when MR is equal to zero, is just, you can view that as having calculated where the critical point of the phi 4 theory is. Okay. So you have, in fact, this dictionary. In high energy physics, in fact, you start from low energy and you adjust what's happening at high energy. In statistical physics, in general, you know what's happening at short distance, therefore high energy, and you ask what's going on at low energy. But you have this dictionary. And therefore, instead of doing this renormalization by fixing this and adjusting, you can do the opposite. That's another way to look at renormalization group in high energy physics. Okay, so that's what I'm going to do, I think, tomorrow. So tomorrow, I'm going to do a Wilsonian-like calculation of renormalization on phi to the 4 at one loop, and to show you the connection between Wilson and what I did before. What we did. And I'm going to rely on that, on tools that we have introduced. So what I'm going to do is to do this calculation in what's called the local potential approximation. And we're going to see what it means. And in fact, this relies on the calculation of the definition of the effective action. Remember, gamma of phi that we have done. So the effective action at one loop will be used. We'll see that we can do very fast, very quickly and very easily a renormalization group calculation using the formula that we have derived for the effective action at one loop. So you are going to see that the effective action is indeed of use, although it seems a bit abstract concept, it's of use for physical calculation. Okay, I think I'm done for today. Thank you.